He knows that there's no point in getting there early. He gets there on time, and that's what the post office is, on-time delivery. So thank you, Chuck, for being with us. We're going to be talking about what's happening to our post office, our postal services. Post offices are being closed. Others are being sold, including there's plans to sell the one that I use, the old Chelsea Post Office on 18th Street. But there's a movement to try to stop this, and that's what we're going to be talking about in the first half of the program. And then later on, we're going to meet Father Michael Lapsley, a freedom fighter in South Africa turned healer. So thanks for being with us here on News Dissector Radio. Here's a song to get us into the postal state of mind. Okay, let's not bother. Okay, what we were going to do was give you the old Motown song about delivering the letter, the sooner the better, and the Marvelettes song. Postman, sing it for us. Go on.
There's a letter in your bag for me.
Chuck, you want to join him?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Where's that letter, man?
That's the song. That's the song. So
I'm dying
over here.
We're going to be going now. We want to tell you it's a little bit awkward here because the person who was at the board left the board. A new person came on. We didn't get a chance to really talk and meet and whatnot. So we're improvising as best we can. Bear with us, if you will. It's not a big deal. And we're going to be hearing about a fight back, an effort to try to not only try to stop these closures of post offices, but also a unique effort to link the attempt to close the post office in Berkeley, California, with the attempt to close the post office in Bronx, New York. From Berkeley to the Bronx, we're going to hear about that. Is our guest with us? Hello?
Hello, guest. Please tell me when he does. Thank you.
Okay, Chuck, you can fill in the gaps here a little bit. I'm so happy you're with us. Tell us a little bit about your background in the post office and this whole issue.
Okay, well, I've worked in the post office for almost 35 years, and I am also the legislative and political director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union, the largest local in the American Postal Workers Union. And I would guess since 2005, I've been dealing with the attempts by the Postal Service to close, downsize, reduce, provide less service for people, and have been involved in the fight back to first uncover what the real motivation was behind all this stuff, and then to organize with local communities and some elected officials and postal workers to mount a campaign to keep the people's post office.
Well, you know, a lot of the way people understand this is that postal workers are making too much money, they're overpaid, they have cushy jobs and the like, and therefore we have to cut back. These are times of austerity and the like. But, of course, that is not the truth at all. Joining us on the phone right now from Berkeley, California, is another activist, historian, who's working on this whole issue. Could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you've been up to?
Sure. I'm Gray Brecken. I'm the project scholar for the Living New Deal Project at the Geography Department at UC Berkeley. And I got involved in this a few years ago, actually, when I became aware that the Postal Service was selling off some magnificent post offices around the country, and with them, the New Deal art that's in those post offices, which belong to all the people of the United States who paid for them. And so I've become increasingly concerned about this, particularly because last year the Postal Service said it was going to sell Berkeley's downtown post office. It's a century-old building, a magnificent building, with two New Deal works of art in it, so it became quite personal. And I've really been following this closely. As I must say, the U.S. press has not been. The press has been totally missing in action about what is going on, who's behind it, and particularly the political ties to Senator Dianne Feinstein in the sale of these often magnificent buildings and their works of art.
Well, it's not surprising the media lack of kind of knowledge, lack of interest, lack of attention being paid to this issue. It's one of many that don't get sufficient attention. But this is something that, you know, every American is connected to. This is not a marginal issue. This is not a side issue. The post offices, in part, were there to help unify our nation. That was the whole point of post offices when the post office was first created. And the post office has been a center of community, of communication, of you know, trying to serve people in their homes, on their streets, you know, in where we live. And this whole effort has been sort of introduced as a way of cost cutting, but it really isn't that, is it, Chuck?
No, I mean, the whole thing is really to privatize the post office. I mean, that's really the ultimate goal. Gary, nice to speak with you. I've certainly read enough about you lately.
Sure, thanks very much.
And to what, I mean, these post offices, the ones that were built during the New Deal, they were in the center of the communities, and they became community centers. And for that reason, also, whatever community they're in, they're prime real estate because the community built up around the post office. And it's one aspect of the war on the post office, and it's done primarily because of the importance that the post office has, how much business it does, and the fact that there are people who want that for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget the Pony Express. Paul R. Levine is with us. He was, I think, part of the original Pony Express.
I was one of the drivers. I programmed the music.
But at any rate, I mean, this is part of our history. This is not something, you know, that's just sort of surfaced as an issue. And yet, a complicated funding formula, where money was put ahead to pay for the retirement of people, has sort of undermined the finances, the operating, finances of the post office, creating an artificial crisis, as far as I can tell.
Is it not true that the post office is losing, like, billions of dollars?
Well, the only reason that it's losing billions of dollars is because of congressional mandates, which have forced the Postal Service to basically subsidize the Treasury, as opposed to what people think. The Post Office doesn't receive any subsidies from the government, and even prior to the 2006 bill, has been used as a cash cow by the Treasury for decades.
So, in other words, the Post. Let's explain this now. Terms like cash cow might be a little too complicated in this day and age. You know, what we're talking about here is the U.S. government, rather than funding the post office, is being funded by the post office. Okay, am I right?
Well, exactly. This goes back to when it first became an independent agency where it would have to pay the employer's share into pension funds. Back then, they were being overcharged for the pension funds. Billions of two independent studies, one that the Postal Service Office of Inspector General hired a firm to study. They came out with the figure of $75 billion in overpayments. Following that, the Postal Regulatory Commission, which is an independent agency, they funded their own study, and they said it was only $50 billion overpaid into the pension funds. This is prior to the pre-funding of the health plan,
with billions
of dollars.
And with the creation of this corporation, weren't the salaries also extremely high for the executives?
Well, I mean, they had, following the great postal strike of 1970, which forced them to make changes, which brought about the agency, they originally brought in executives from the American Can Company to make the place run like a corporation. But despite all of this, even with the electronic mail, email, even with the collapse of the economy in 2008, the post office would still be surviving fine if it wasn't for the congressional mandates that came in 2006.
Now, and, you know, that's actually another place where the media has totally been absent. I have never seen a good investigative report on how the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, that's the act of 2006, how that was passed, who wrote it. It has all the dirty fingerprints of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, all over it. That's a right-wing organization that drafts such legislation. It was passed by a lame duck Republican Congress by a voice vote, so you can't identify who actually voted for it, and it was signed by none other than George W. Bush, no friend of the public domain.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a number I'm looking at right now says the United States Postal Service would have a $1.5 billion surplus if it wasn't for the pre-funding rules set by the Republican majority in Congress. And this is something that Senator Bernie Sanders is challenging, and something that, you know, I think all of us need to be aware of. One of the things that really interests me about what you're doing there, Gary, is that you've twinned the future of the post office in Berkeley, California, with the future of the post office in the Bronx, New York. Tell us about the Bronx side of this story, since we're based here in New York City.
Well, we, as I say, you know, in Berkeley, we've become aware of it. It's very personal to us because our post office is for sale. But over the last couple of years, I've become aware that post offices are going up for sale all over the country, and that the press wasn't covering it. And so people in places like Northfield, Minnesota, for example, La Jolla, they knew that their post offices were going on the market, but they didn't know that there were many other communities that were being similarly affected, as well as, of course, many rural communities that are losing their post offices. Well, a couple of months ago, the people of the Bronx found out that their central post office was going to go on the market, too. You know, it was done in a very kind of midnight manner. That is a magnificent post office built during the New Deal, and it's decorated with 13 large murals by Ben Shahn, one of the most famous American social realist artists. I mean, it's really an American landmark, but that didn't stop them. They put that on the market. So here in Berkeley, we formed a National Post Office Collaborate, which you can Google, please do. We're reaching out to communities around the country, starting with the Bronx, to initiate legal action against the post office to try to at least slow down, if not stop, these sales, which have received no public scrutiny whatsoever,
yeah, I mean,
particularly
because
of the art within them.
You know, I mean, I saw an announcement plastered up in the wall in Chelsea saying, you know, public hearing on the closing of the post office, you know. I hadn't heard anything about it, and, you know, it seemed like it was almost a fait accompli, you know, that they were going to close this post office.
That's the way that it happens. They just put up a post, a notice. Very few people see them. They might have a meeting, often during working hour, no matter how much community opposition is, after the comment period, which is a few weeks, they will then inform the community that the post office is for sale anyway. So these meetings are largely pro forma. Now, what's really driving this, Danny, is the giant real estate company, CBRE. CBRE is the company that the post office management gave an exclusive contract to last year to not only market the post offices. CBRE represents both the seller and the buyer, and it advises the post office in which properties to sell. This is an extraordinarily plummy contract because, as your other guest said, these pieces of real estate are usually at the very center of American cities and towns, so they're often very, very valuable. Now, what's interesting about CBRE is that it is chaired and largely owned by Senator Feinstein's billionaire private equity husband, Richard C. Blum. That's a rather remarkable conflict of interest, and yet there's been no investigation of how that contract happened.
Well, I mean, it's shocking on every level, I think. But, you know, it's like if they close the post offices today, what's to stop them from closing the parks and the playgrounds tomorrow? It's all,
exactly,
you know, real estate that we can make money off of. And, you know, this is, I think, the big danger here of privatization, you know, is that it's sort of stealth. And stealth means you know, that things happen without people really knowing. So the, you know, that's the problem that we, you know, that we're facing. Chuck, what about the workers? What about workers, man? Are the postal workers concerned about this and involved in this?
Well, postal workers for a long time had it pretty good with no layoff clause and a sense that, and with union protection, that we somehow would be separate from all this other stuff that was being done against the public workers. But now people begin to see, because there's so many elements to this, it's not just the selling of these historic post offices, but it's the consolidating and closing of mail distribution centers, cutting back in hours, just every possible way. So people see that we are indeed engaged in a war, and this is one of the fronts in that war, but it really is trying to destroy the Postal Service as a means of privatizing it. So yes, well, workers are more and more involved. I mean, yesterday we had a nice march and occupying of the Peter Stuyvesant post office. This isn't one that the post office owns. This is one that they lease, and they decided that they wouldn't lease it anymore and then relocate. So people went in there with giant postcards and occupied and mailed them to the president, the head of the Postal Board of Governors, the Postal Regulatory Commission, and the character in the Northeast, Mulvey, who's the hatchet man that goes around for these, you know, show trials of having public hearings and whatever. And he's a questionable character. And his boss, Mara, is the guy who decides which post offices are to be sold, and then when the appeals come out, they go to him. He then decides if his decision, his judgment was justified. So it really is, I guess, the weakness of Title 39 that allows them to do this stuff. But it's easier for the Postal Service to sell a post office than it is just to close one.
So what kind of response have you had in Berkeley to your campaign there? Because I think it's important that we think about this as a national issue, not simply, you know, a New York problem or even a labor problem. Greg?
Well, Berkeley's been very, very active. We had a very rowdy couple of meetings with the U.S. Postal Service representatives. The city council and the mayor unanimously voted to oppose. Just a second. Just a moment. They voted to oppose the sale of the post office. The community's in total unanimous opposition to it. As I said, that didn't help at all. So that's why we decided with the National Post Office Collaborate to reach out to other communities to see if we could form a national coalition to fight this through legal action.
There's a great website on this, by the way, just for people listening, SaveThePostOffice.com.
Right.
That is the go-to site, because the problem with this is it's quite complex. It doesn't lend itself to sound bites. You really have to educate themselves, and so SaveThePostOffice.com is the place to go to learn about what's actually happening. I just wanted to add that the Postmaster General, Donahoe, wrote a letter to the mayor in response to the protest. He boasted that they have, since 2006, laid off 193,000 postal employees through attrition. And then he had the gall to say that they had provided increased access to postal products and services. Of course, anybody who has been watching knows it's been exactly the opposite. They've shrunk postal products and services, which is discouraging people from using the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah, well, how much money does UPS and FedEx spend in lobbying and political donations and contributions?
They're very generous.
There you go.
And they're also both still members of ALEC. They haven't withdrawn when all the bad publicity came out with large corporations left. They're still in there.
So there you have, you know, companies that are in for their own self-interest. The public interest, however, is not being served very well, because most of our political leaders are not talking about this. Most of the media is not talking about this.
They're not. You know, I pretty much know what's going on. But I, you know, what I know about the post office, it's not a real sexy topic, but is that it's in debt. And because we all get email, you know, practically the only thing the post office is used for now is to deliver junk mail. And then I say, well,
no,
yeah, because that's all
true.
I get in the box. But that's
that,
all we get in the media.
I know, but that's you're leaving a word out. It's the corporate media. And then and the large companies that control the corporate media has stuff at stake too, because they're also big mailers as well. The biggest year of volume in the history of the Postal Service was 2006. Actually, that's the year they always used to use the fall off. But 2005, 2007 were the three biggest years of volume in the history of the Postal Service, and that's well into the internet era. That's the appeal to the privatizers, because even in a bad year, the post office does $60 billion worth of business. And it's not true, because while people aren't writing letters to grandma like they used to, grandma's still getting her medications through the Postal Service. And her grandkids are probably getting their, you know, Netflix through the post office. And they still haven't figured out a way for you to buy something through the internet where the shirt or the book comes through the screen or the keyboard. It's delivered
right,
to
right.
you.
But, Chuck, do you know, my kid in freshman year in college, does he write to me? Does he write me a nice letter? No.
He never writes. He never calls.
Never
right.
writes. No,
right.
he calls. He calls. He just, but does he write me
so
a nice
right.
letter? No.
But is he still getting stuff delivered through the internet, delivered to him by the postal
every
service?
Every damn thing I send him, yeah.
Yeah, so the nature of the, quote, business of it has changed, but the reality is that the people who are most dependent upon the postal service, the elderly, disabled people, disabled veterans, poor people, small business owners, they can't fall for the alternative, and they're the ones who should be subsidized to use the post office, but every time there's a rate increase, it's a first-class rate, but the mass of mailers who do the business mail, whatever, they're the ones who are getting the discount rate. It's all backwards.
Well, that's I have one other constituency, and that's rural America.
I was about
rural
to
America
mention that, yeah.
depends largely, completely, really, on the Postal Service, and if this destruction of the Postal Service goes through, large parts of rural America will be deprived of any mail service at all.
So, people, let's put this issue on our agenda. Let's try to find out more about it. Let's try to support the people who are trying to stop the closing of post offices. There was an effort to discontinue all Saturday delivery that was resisted and fought back. People are fighting for post offices, but that's really a fight for the public space and for the public interest. It's not just about mail. It's about whether or not the resources of our country should be totally controlled by private interests who have no really interest in serving the larger community. Can you just give us your website out there in Berkeley so people can find out more about it? I'd love them to see these murals that you were referencing before.
Well, sure. The website for the postal group is the National Post Office Collaborate, and you can just find that by Googling. And my own project is the Living New Deal. That's livingnewdeal.berkeley.edu, or you can just Google Living New Deal. And our project is to identify and interpret the entire public works legacy left to us by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal administrations during the Great Depression, which got us out of the Great Depression, I might add. But it's all around us. We use it. Much of it is extraordinarily beautiful.
Thank
you.
So
if you're curious about what the New Deal did for your town and what
Thank
you are
you.
Still using, use the Living New Deal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're now living a bad deal. Chuck, information about your activities?
Well, if people want to reach me, they can reach me at 212-563-7553. That's 212-563-7553. My name is Chuck Slatkin. That's the phone number of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. You can reach me there or leave a message. And believe me, if you're interested in this, we will work with you.
And I endorse that message. So thank you very much, Chuck, for dropping by. Thank you. It's a little hectic here, but we really appreciate your input and your information. Father Michael Lapsley, from South Africa, a fighter on the front line for freedom, is going to be with us in a few minutes. Stay with us now on News Dissector Radio. Well, that's the South African music of Sipho, Hot Sticks, Mabuse. What a great artist. And we're going to go out with the number 7 song on that track at the end of the show. Number 7, that's our lucky number. It's the song about Nelson Mandela. We're going to hear that when we go out. But right now, we're so happy to have with us in the studio Father Michael Lapsley. Michael Lapsley is someone that I've known for many, many years, who was at one point a chaplain of the African National Congress. One day in 1990, he got a letter in the mail, a letter bomb that nearly killed him and took off both of his hands and one of his eyes. And he's now written a book which is a beautifully written, Redeeming the Past, My Journey from Freedom Fighter to Healer. Michael Lapsley actually was born in New Zealand, but he's been involved in the struggle for freedom in South Africa, and now he's involved in kind of another layer of that struggle, a struggle of healing, a struggle to try to get people to talk about the pain that they've suffered and the hopes that they have. And the other night here in New York, Father Michael, as some Brother Michael, Father Michael, I've heard both variations, gave a little talk that was very well attended by South Africans here in New York, and I was really impressed with it, and I prevailed upon him to come in and share some of his thinking with us. Michael, welcome to Progressive Radio Network. Tell us a little bit about your story in a way, your work, and let's get into it.
Well, thanks, Denny, and it's great to be with you and all the listeners. I'm sure
you got to get closer. Can you push that a little bit further? Yeah.
Thank you, Denny. Good to be with you. Good to be with the listeners across the world. And thank you for your own contribution and support of our own struggle for freedom and democracy over a very long time. So it's a delight to be here with my colleague here, Charles Mander. We're both part of the Institute for Healing of Memories. Now, the Institute for Healing of Memories began life as a parallel process to South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But perhaps to take back a step, I was a chaplain of the African National Congress of South Africa, and I was with the ANC in exile, first in the tiny country of Lesotho, as you know, completely surrounded by South Africa, and then in Zimbabwe. And in April of 1990, I received a letter bomb, which, you know, sometimes journalists say to me, do you think that has an effect on you? And I say, well, actually, yes. And, of course, anything which is life-threatening will be life-changing. And I, one way I describe my journey, which is part of the title of the book, From Freedom Fighter to Healer. And in some ways, my own journey echoes, in its own small, modest way, the journey of the people of South Africa. You know, we had a monster we needed to slay. We needed to end constitutionalized racism. And we did that. But then the time came when we got the vote, we elected a democratic government, our government, morally legitimate. But then we had to deal with the legacy of more than 300 years of colonialism and racism and apartheid. And the thing that struck me, I came back to South Africa after being away for 16 years. And what struck me was that we were a damaged nation. We were damaged in our humanity. We were damaged by what we'd done, by what had been done to us, and by what we failed to do. And I realized that, yes, we would have to provide water and electricity and education and healthcare for millions of our people who had never had it. But we'd also have to deal with the human heart. We'd have to deal with what we had inside of us as a consequence of the nation's journey. And, of course, one of the principal ways South Africa sought to deal with the past was through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We sought to lay bare what had happened in darkness and the light of day.
These are the human rights abuses
and
the terrible suffering of of many people.
And particularly the gross human rights violations, murder, torture, attempted murder, severe maltreatment. But in some ways we dealt, if you like, with the bottom of the iceberg, but the iceberg was still gigantic. So, for example, under apartheid, 3.5 million people were forcibly removed from their homes. But those stories didn't qualify to come to the commission. And that's not a criticism of the commission, but rather to say that every South African had a story to tell. Every South African had been affected. We all had stuff in us as a consequence of the nation's journey. And that's what led some of us to start a process that we call the healing of the memories, creating safe and sacred spaces where people could begin to deal with how the nation's past had affected them psychologically, emotionally, spiritually.
Can you give us an example of the process that and the way it works and what you've been trying to do? Do you bring people together for workshops? Do you bring people together in churches? How do people get to have their say, so to speak, and
right.
hear other people have their say? Because, you know, it's not part of the problem of being a victim of human rights abuses. Sometimes you feel like you're the only one and no one else will ever understand what you went through.
Yes, no, thank you for that. And you're quite right, Tanya. I mean, I think even when there has been mass suffering or mass oppression, people often feel very alone in their pain because they know that others have suffered. They don't know others have the same feelings. So ours is a collective process. Our core business is running what we call healing of the memories workshops. And in fact, we're actually going to have one in Ossining up in New York State this weekend.
That's a significant place. I don't know if you're aware of it, but that's the prison at Sing Sing, as it was called, was the place where the Rosenbergs were actually electrocuted in the 50s as sort of victims of the Red Scares in the United States. It's not clear if Julius Rosenberg was working with the Russians, but his wife certainly wasn't, but she was killed as well. Okay.
Yes.
So it's a
horror place in that sense.
It's our Robben Island in some respect, symbolically, Sing Sing.
We'll actually be with the Marino sisters, who are famous for good things.
Yeah, and who have done great work there.
Tell me about
the process.
Yeah, well, so what I was going to say, so 20-25 people at a time, precisely addressing the point you're making, collective process. And we often say our workshops are not discussion workshops. They're talking and listening. So in a 2.5-day process, we seek to create a community. We take people through experiential exercises. So, for example, we get people to draw their life story. And then in small groups of 6 or 7 people, one by one, people tell their story with a great emphasis on how they feel about what's happened. And we emphasize the feelings because the poison, if you like, lies in not what people think about what happened. It's what they feel. And you know, for example, people who have been oppressed, maltreated, have every reason to hate, to be bitter, to want revenge. The problem is that those feelings, while totally justifiable, destroy us. They don't destroy our enemies. So we need to find the space where, if you like, we can be heard, where our pain can be acknowledged.
I mean, we're talking about kind of very deep trauma. You know, and trauma is not just something that happens to veterans in war. Trauma can happen to the man who loses his job after 20 years and can't find another one, who can't support his family. You know, the level of sexual violence, the level of violence against children in our culture, certainly in South Africa, but here as well, creates trauma on a massive scale, and it goes untreated in a way because it doesn't show up on an x-ray.
Yeah, and also, Danny, poverty dehumanizes people. Poverty creates its own trauma. But if you think, I mean, our work in the United States, an example of illustrating the point you've just made is that here in New York State, we work with a center for women who have been abused who are also disabled. In Minnesota, we are working with people in the faith community and homeless war veterans. And a terrible reality is that a disproportionate number of homeless people are war veterans. And sometimes people came to the military already with trauma out of their family lives. And then they had the whole experience of war.
I think a little kid who's called a name at school you know, day after day after day develops a trauma. Not as intense a level, but a seed is planted there that's going to grow.
Yes, it's interesting how often, whether we frame our workshops in terms of people in prison or domestic violence or people from war, we give people an opportunity to tell their whole story. And the example you give is actually surprisingly frequent, the experience of bullying and what that does to a child's sense of self-value. And part of the healing is when you can be in a safe space where your story is acknowledged, reverenced, recognized, and you are valued, because that can be the point that you can begin even to leave victimhood behind and say, yes, that happened to me, it scarred me, but maybe those scars can inch by inch, step by step, begin to heal.
Have people who've gone through the underside of apartheid ever mentioned that? Because I'm sure they were called names on a day-to-day.
How do you mean the underside of apartheid? You're speaking
the underside,
deep American.
The receiving end of apartheid.
Oh yes. I mean, completely. And I mean, I think some of the most terrible damage that apartheid did was precisely the message it gave that you're a second-class citizen, that you are of no worth. And that's, in fact, where we actually begin our work, is recognizing that all South Africans had a story to tell. And apartheid messed us all up. Apartheid oppressed all black people, but the oppressor was also damaged by the things to which they were party. And part of our work is that opportunity for people to tell each other their stories. But even where people have been doing heroic work resisting apartheid, there'll sometimes be elements that they... I always remember a young man coming to a workshop who was regarded as a hero in his community for good reasons. And he said, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about that of which I'm ashamed. And even ironically, by simply being a hero, there was no space for the fullness of his humanity. It is not that the heroism wasn't true, but that was not the totality.
What I like about this effort is that you're not only talking about people who have stories to tell, but every story needs a listener. That you want to create a dynamic interaction between people who have suffered or experienced this kind of pain, but also, they need validation to some degree, don't they? They need to be heard.
Not only to be heard, but to be believed as well. You know, for example, when people are tortured, they're told, don't worry, we won't leave marks or no one will believe you. So people want to have their pain heard. But we could also, we've got another brother here, Charles, who's part of our facilitators. He's from Malawi, but lives in South Africa, and he may also like to add his own comments, or he's being shy today.
It's called radio shy.
Intimidating. We didn't tell him beforehand.
Sit before a microphone. But you see, this is something where people tend to think that we in America have the answers for everyone in the world, you know. And it may be that we also need to reach out to people in other cultures and other societies who have experiences not only with, you know, being victims, but also finding ways of healing their pain. I mean, I think your experience is amazing because, you know, you went through a terrible physical threat to your life, lost both of your hands, lost an eye. I mean, this is almost unthinkable what you went through, and yet you had to find a way, something in yourself, to be able to cope with this and to turn this terrible experience into something more positive. I mean, my father lost a leg, and I know what he went
through. Your father was?
He lost a leg.
Right. So you knew, yeah. I mean, I often say that losing a limb is like losing a loved one. So yes, you get on with your life, but there's always loss as part of your life.
Sometimes there's phantom pain. You're feeling pain even though that part of your body isn't there.
Yes, that's true. I was very fortunate in that respect, in that the medical people, first in Zimbabwe and then in Australia, were able to deal with the pain in such a way that I have no phantom pain. But it's true that amputees, even for decades later, can suffer from phantom pain. They have pain in the leg, but the leg is not there. So how do you heal that? But I think also we say that to people, come to our workshop and we promise you one step towards healing. You know, we our Westerners makes us think that it should be like magic, quick fix, take the pill, and we'll all be okay. And reality is that healing is a step-by-step journey. But a workshop for some will be a turning point, especially if it's the first time they've ever told their story in a safe space, and people have believed them, they've listened to them reverently and respectfully. And that can be the point that people begin the first step of leaving victimhood behind. You know, one of our great leaders in South Africa said once, those who think of themselves as victims eventually become the victimizers of others. And people give themselves permission to do terrible things to other human beings because of what was done to them.
It's what they suffered, and they feel, you know, this is something that really needs a tremendous amount of honesty, okay? People have to really deal with their own feelings, their own frustrations, and their own flaws and failures. I mean, you can't simply deal with this as if it's somebody else's problem, because in many cases we're tied together in a culture where, you know, these kinds of issues are very much present in our lives, if not in our lives, in the lives of our family members.
Yes, and the trauma that people close to us experience has an effect on us. So if you think, for example, in this terrible incident in Boston, all those people who lost limbs, but then there are their lovers and friends and aunts and uncles, and sometimes it's a surprising thing in some ways, but sometimes the relatives of victims have a harder time healing than the direct survivors, because sometimes the relatives almost feel they owe it to the one who's gone, who's been injured, to keep hatred alive, where sometimes the direct survivor has it within them to travel a journey of compassion and even of forgiveness.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because a person who's a victim of that, their full focus, I imagine, would be on moving life ahead and finding positivity, where the relatives, the focus, that's not their focus.
Right, and so sometimes, not always, but sometimes the relatives get stuck. But I think, you know, even if, like there are stories coming out of Boston of extraordinary bravery and determination, but those people also need the points where they can cry and be sad and be vulnerable as well.
And,
you know, because none of us are simply strong people. We're also weak people. We also have our points of vulnerability.
Yeah.
You need permission for that, because if you've got the permission to be weak, that then sometimes frees you to, ironically, to be strong.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to kind of go back to the peace and reconciliation experience in South Africa, because here was a very racially divided country, racially divided by law, by tradition, by culture, and you know, that was a sort of a central dynamic of the society, in the same way that it has been here, although not really as acknowledged, you know, that racism, slavery, the experiences of demonization, stereotyping of people is very alive and well in the United States. But
so old wounds still infect the present.
Yeah.
And to be able to acknowledge that, to be able to cope with that, to be able to...
Because if you acknowledge it, you can begin to address it. You can't deal with what is, you know, not acknowledged.
But there are a lot of people who are in denial about it. In other words, they'll say, okay, well, we have the BEE in South Africa. We have certain points for people who are now, you know, getting jobs that they, because of their race, because of their background, and yet many feel very inauthentic, and many get caught up in a system of terrible corruption to try to keep up with the Joneses, to keep up with the pretense of it all. I mean, there's a tremendous, one of the things, I've been in South Africa a lot in the last year, and, you know, repossession of automobiles, people who suddenly go, you know, full stop into the middle class.
They're and
suddenly
live beyond their means.
Living beyond their means. They have no experience with money. They have family members who say, oh, you're rich now. Give me this, give me that. And in the end, all of it's taken back because they don't really know how to handle and manage it, which leads to more anger, which leads to more frustration, and which also leads to more violence.
Well, that happens here, too. I mean, look at the problems we've had with debt from people who've just watched everybody on TV because the only people you see on TV are famous, wealthy people. Why don't I have this, yeah. You know? And then someone comes along and says, hey, you want to have your own home here, you know, these predatory mortgages.
Yeah, the sort of shortcut. I mean, I think
we
have in South Africa, as you do in the United States, we have obscene poverty side by side with obscene wealth.
Yeah.
And so if you're living in the dehumanization or trauma of poverty, it's tempting to say, let's look for the shortcuts.
Right.
And whether the shortcut be, yeah. You know, criminality or crookery of
yeah.
some.
Yeah, well, life is short. Kind of, yeah. Everybody
wants
that
shortcut.
And also
you think, shortcut. Oh, well, why can't I have all of that?
You know, yeah.
Inequality in South Africa was probably the highest levels in the world, maybe next to Brazil, South Africa. There was sort of a contest about who was the most unequal. But I think the United States is pushing them both out of the top.
I think so.
The top yeah. league here because inequality in the United States, which is masked in many ways, the appearance, as if you have a credit card, you can give up the appearance of wealth, but a lot of people are living.
I think that mask
way
is
beyond,
dropping away.
Way beyond their means.
And if you think about it, doesn't bring peace to the. I mean, it doesn't bring peace in the United States. It doesn't bring peace in the world, which is why, in a sense, South Africa is the world in a dramatic form, and it's important if we're ever going to live together in peace as a people that we address that.
Well, people need to live in peace within oneself.
Well,
if you think about the kids being called names every day, think about the people who are watching all these, you know, all the celebs on TV. They're calling themselves names. They're saying loser. I'm a loser. I'm a loser because I'm not this guy. I'm not pretty like her. I don't have money like them. You can't not feed that self-abuse.
And so then you're not at peace with yourself.
You're not at peace with yourself, and you're going to take it out on somebody.
I think all the things we're saying is that, I mean, yes, we attend to the political and the social and economic, but we have to deal with the psychological, the
exactly.
emotional, and the spiritual as well. It's not either or.
Yeah.
It has to be. Yeah. You know,
well, this is a discussion that could go on for a long time and should go on for a long time. Again, the book here, Redeeming the Past, My Journey from Freedom Fighter to Healer, Father Michael Lapsley. And this book is from Orbis Books. It's something that you really must read because it's not only a memoir, but it's also a discussion of some of the central challenges that we face as people, as human beings in this time and in this place. If you find this conversation of value, if you appreciate what we're trying to do here on PRN, Progressive Radio Network, News Dissector Radio, please drop me a note, dissector@mediachannel.org. The actual podcast of this program is going to be available later tonight, and I'm going to have it on my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow. And it's also in the archive. It will be in the archives of the PRN.FM Progressive Radio Network. So you'll be able to hear it and share it with your friends as well. It's a great honor to have you with us. I'm sorry the half hour went by very
just
quickly.
Like
yeah,
very,
really.
Just like
you
that.
Did,
but you moved the clock too quickly.
But I think having you in studio really made a difference. You know, you have a prophetic voice and an important voice, and people should recognize this is not just a South African issue. This is a global issue. And the work that you're doing about the healing of memories is very important. The website is IHOMN. No, no, that's the email. What is the
Healingofmemories.org, healing-memories.org. But if you just ask Ms. Google for Healing of Memories, our website, both the North American and the South African.
Please check this out, people. I think you'll be as moved as I was. And it's really important. Paula Levine, thank you for being with us. We're trying to do a lot here.
A great discussion.
In the studio. And, you know, the takeaway is that if you are feeling any of this pain, you're not alone, and you can do something about it. You can talk about it. You can hear what others have to say about it. Do we agree on that point? Yes, we do. Good. So we're going to go out now with a song again by the great Sipho Hotsticks Mabuse, South African artist, friend of mine. I was just in South Africa, and they were recreating the ANC party from 1994 in this hotel in Johannesburg for the movie. And Hotsticks had played at the original event. He was playing at the movie. And I'm there, you know, checking in. All of a sudden he says, Danny, Why are you here? What are you doing? You know, so it was kind of a link. And his is a, I picked up the album, The Ultimate Hot Sticks, the Ultimate Collection, Sipo Hot Sticks Mabuse. Let's go out with that. Thank you for being with us again this week on PRN FM.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.